Welcome to Risk Sleep Repeat, a podcast that features influential guest speakers from the world of fire, health and safety. We're going to focus on trust-based safety, owning and embracing risk, and the importance of people over paperwork. Hosted by me, Adam Clark, Managing Director, and Mike Stevens, CEO of Praxis 42. If you're a fire, health and safety professional, join us for inspirational conversations about the future of our industry. In this episode, I spoke to Crystal Danbury, Group Head of Safety and Insurance at Sainsbury's. Crystal is a chartered member of IOSH with 20 years experience across high-risk industry, including nuclear, rail, transport and telecoms. We discussed our thoughts on the future of our industry, taking a more human approach and the importance of a work-life balance. So we've got quite a high-level agenda here around what do we see as the vision for the industry, and that's all around people and making sure that people can get home. Now, obviously, in people isn't the only thing in industry. We've got to worry about, you know, resources and outcome and survival. But having quite a really strong vision there, that's at really top level. I'm really interested then into how do we drill that down into the strategy, but more importantly, how does that translate into day-to-day brilliant culture around health and safety?
Yeah, amazing. Really great question. I would say if you are clear on your purpose, which is people-driven, which means if you're people-driven, you're naturally harm-driven, right? Because you're thinking, how are my guys affected? It changes your questions. It changes your questions to your team. And if you talk to anybody in any of my teams, they will say to you, I don't tend to say, what's the fatality weighted index at the moment? You know, I don't tend to ask any question that really has a number in it. I say, how many people did we hurt last year and how many people did we hurt this year? And then my follow-up question is always, how did we hurt them? Where were they hurt?
So for people who haven't experienced that Crystal line of questioning in the past, what's their first initial reaction to those, that way of framing it?
I think so, really interesting, because I'm asking about people, you still have to go back and look at your system. You still have to go back and say, we've hurt 15 people this year, Crystal. I'm asking about data, but with a human feel. And people find that really confusing to say, I feel like we're being really data driven, Crystal, because you're asking me lots of questions about how many people we have hurt or how we are hurting people. But out the way we are talking about those numbers is very different. So I think lots of people take a moment to settle into the sort of hybrid approach, which is I still definitely want to know who we're hurting, but I want to know how often does that happen? We're breaking ankles, let's say. If I said to you, Adam, we had 15 accidents last year, but we had 17 the year before. How do you feel about that?
Oh, well, we're clearly trending in the right direction, aren't we?
Right. Everything's going well. Any emotion in there or just...
I don't know, because I'm not sure about John Smith or Joe Bloggs, you know. I suppose it depends. If you said to me, well, we had 15 this year, but, oh, by the way, Jane over there no longer has a leg, that suddenly changes your thoughts on it. Or perhaps if you represented your statistics with a picture of all the people who got hurt, that would, you know, even the most hardened person would hopefully take some empathy from that.
Exactly. And that's the whole thing, is you're creating empathy. We naturally have to look at numbers. It's the dry part of the job, but it's really interesting. Now, if I said to you, we hurt 15 people, 12 of those were major, and they typically all happened on this site doing this activity, my instant reaction inside is concern. I am humanly concerned about that site, those people there. And I quite naturally actually also want to go see it. If I say to you, we've had 17, it's gone to 15, we're hoping for 14 this year, everyone's like, well, this feels positive. It doesn't allow you to get concerned for the individual. Therefore, it doesn't really allow you to think outside the box. Just you look at a downward trend and say, yay. And, you know, if you're ever looking for a solution or a way to awaken a business to a problem, you don't ever land on the first solution, but you start with a really good brainstorm and you start with the nugget, which is how do we get people into the centre of our message? And so you just get a paper from me like you would any other safety professional. But my language tends to be slightly different. So rather than just give you a couple of bar graphs to say things are going down and then a little asterisk underneath to say X proportion happened at a particular site, I will say we hurt this many people.
And have you found that at the top level then generates more conversation?
It's always difficult, isn't it? I don't know what the conversation was before I got into the room, naturally, but I find really good conversation. People can feel instantly defensive when you talk about that, but that's really good. It's a human response rather than, did everyone do the pre-read for the safety paper? Everyone nods and you say, right, we'll move on, right?
It's always great when health and safety is just above AOB on the agenda and, yes. You know, when time overruns, oh, should we just cut it till next week?
Oh, yeah. And I think that's the bit that's slightly different. Whereas if you get, let's say you get a pre-read and it says we hurt X amount of people on this site, typically the person that owns that site in the room will feel compelled to say, even if, and forget, you have to start with where you are culture-wise. You can't, you know where you're going. We're going to go that everybody on that board cares about everybody getting home. And I think they do. We are all human, but I think some people just need reminding.
Yeah. And when presenting that, though, I'm really interested in the, you know, we talk about blame culture. Mm. When you're presenting that and it's a site and you've got that person who's responsible in that room, do they then instantly feel uncomfortable and having to go into defensive mode? Or is it going the other way? And it's like, well, OK, this has happened. I want to own this now.
Yeah. So I think very naturally what you tend to get is defensiveness. But I think that's where I tend to glean that this is the first time we've had real conversations. About human conversations about safety is everybody gets really, really reactive and everyone gets really defensive. And typically the question that would come back from me, not here, but before, would be, what are you doing about it then? It's your job, Crystal. What are you doing about it? And actually, my response pretty much always is, if I found a problem, I'm not going to go in and blindside anybody so they get a kick in from a director afterwards. I'll say, I'm working with your team to understand how we can take care of people better. I'm working with your team to discover how we can change that process.
That, to me, embodies how do we actually allow change to happen. It's just taking the blame out of the way, and it's a, you know, we're, and exactly that, working together, we're collaborating, I want to observe, using all these really positive words that you're not in your own here, I'm here to enable this. And, you know, from my point of view, Crystal, I spent a lot of time trying to work with people to say it's not the health and safety team's job to write everything for you and do everything for you. They're there to support and enable. They're not there just to, oh, right, yeah, it's that time again. You know, 12 months have surpassed. Can you just go and review my risk assessments and then just put them back in the folder again? Mm. You know, it's breaking that cycle.
Yep. Well, I mean, how amazing would it be if we made risk assessments useful?
Oh, sorry. Did you risk assessments useful?
How amazing would it be if it was a, how are we going to progress from this year to next year? How are we going to improve our site? How amazing would that be if they didn't go in a drawer or got stuck on a share drive and get pulled out if we need to go to court? Wouldn't it be amazing?
And can we start off writing a risk assessment with a team of people and maybe a whiteboard and just talking about what is it that we're actually going to do in this activity? You know, what are the things that if we don't do it right is going to, you know, have an immediate impact in, ow, that really hurt, or, mm-hmm. you know, in a few years' time, oh, this is starting to hurt.
So I, when I was at OpenReach, I introduced something called a HazDash. So you have massive packs to put up poles and do really big pieces of work, right? And naturally embedded in the, I don't know, 100 pages is a risk assessment. Like, yay, right? That nobody ever reads, because whoever's doing that job has done it 50 times before, a million times before. And it's just in there really to cover the tail of the organisation. Let's be really honest. And I said, forget it. The risk assessment is supposed to alert the person to the hazards they're going to interact with. And then we're supposed to say that hazard could cause you harm. It's, you know, if you use, I don't know, gloves, if you use this jack, you will mitigate that risk of harm. That's what it's meant to do. And I just said, well, let's just be really real. Let's just create a front sheet that just has big fat symbols that says of the things that are going to hurt you. Typically, it's working in water. It's the pole itself, if you have to manually jack it. Like, we know electric, we know these things. It doesn't take an awful lot to create a symbol for all of them so that when that guy picks up, he says, oh, didn't know this job was going to be working in water. And then there you have it. You just simplify it, because I am not reading 50 pages. And if you've designed a document for me, and I'm operational and I have a KPI to hit every day.
You're just not going to have the time. No. And that's that again is for me is it's thinking about what is going to be the most effective way of doing that, bearing in mind people have a limited amount of time. And if you're only going to get across to them the most important message that they need to know, that's what you need to focus on. And you know, obviously there are different levels of people. Doesn't mean that really competent people can't make mistakes, but they're more likely to experience that. What we need to make sure, and I think my view is that we've got better over time with those newer people coming into the organisation, that health and safety is actually being embedded from day one. We've moved away from the there's the apprentice, let's go and make him ask for a long wait somewhere. It's about actually you need to be understanding of health and safety from day one. And actually, you know, looking at new people coming into the construction industry and when they're at college, you know, health and safety now is actually a key part of the module. Now how effective it's delivered is another thing, but you know, people are very aware of it.
Yeah. So one of the things I was going to say is, as well as that HAZDASH thing, we were talking about hazards that if you write your risk assessment in an office and not with people that are doing the task, you miss the nuances of the job. You get the practical and the logical, but you miss the nuance. And so what I introduced at OpenReach was getting loads of people that have had a particular type of accident in a room with the statistic and said, you tell me what I think I know what that says. But you tell me what the reality is, like what's happened in your day job. And we got a couple of examples of the near miss investigations and stuff and said, what does this actually look like on a day to day? Give us what this guy's day would have looked like.
And again, in an environment of moving that blame culture away, I assume you've had quite a good response back from that session.
So we introduced something that was so incredible as a result of this. So we had a guy, I'll give you an example, who said there are his hidden hazards. So you can't just, you know, tell us just to mind your feet. We walk through fields. There are sinkholes. There are things that we can't flag to anybody else and we can't see as we're walking. Sometimes we're just going to trip over. But there are places where you know, for example, there was a junkyard, there was a pole in, and there was always debris around the bottom of the junkyard, but there's one piece of debris that was fixed, and lo and behold, loads of people tripped on it. And we're like, what? Well, so guys, come on, how do we get around this? What can we do? And we ended up brainstorming in the room with all these engineers. I went away with the problem, so not the solution, with the problem. How do we tell the next engineer coming that that thing is there?
Yep.
And another exploration thing, I looked at the technology progressing around me and I looked at what three words. Didn't know why I was linking the two together. Just phoned one of the guys off LinkedIn, contacted me about what three words. And I was like, all right, we'll have a chat. I'll talk him through some of the things we're challenging. And he said, well, what happens if we can geotag your hazards and let the next engineer know that he's approaching a geotagged hazard?
That sounds pretty awesome.
And I was like, well, that sounds incredible.
Did you do it?
Yeah, we did it.
So how did that work practically then? they have the app. They have the app on their phone, and it pings them.
So I actually, as the last point of implementation, I had left to come here, but it's gone massive. And what I will do is I will get some of the. You can actually find they did an article on LinkedIn. So if you put OpenReach geotagging hazards, they've got an article on how it works. But I left the room with a problem, not a solution. And I spoke to somebody that was owning a new piece of technology without knowing how it could help me, or even if it could, and naturally brought those two things together. And it's amazing.
So for me, Crystal, listening to you say that back, how, you know, I'm thinking how many other health and safety professionals, one, would have started that approach, but two, wanted to actually help, you know, really deliver that, because I'm thinking of the word curiosity. It's your curiosity of, oh, I've got this, there's this thing that's being described, and now it's like me with IT, I'm determined not to let it beat me. You know, I really want to get a result on that. Is that how you describe your view?
I'll say something that I don't, not everybody will agree with. I think zero harm is false and it's mythical, because for as long as you have distracted minds, people going through heartbreak, weather, you're always going to have somebody that may slip or trip over, right? So I think my role is naturally, how can we take out as much harm as we can, right? And bearing in mind we're dealing with humans. And it's definitely within my mind, this trend. Do you know what bugs me more than anything? It's the trend that everyone ignores. That trend that we just say, you know, slips and trips are just a way of life. And I'm like, yeah, but not all of them. Some of them, weather, like I said, a distraction stuff, but not all of them.
So if zero harm's not possible, what do we label it as? Or do we need to label it?
Well, I think this is the thing. I think we get obsessed with the label and the safety one, safety two, and zero harm. And I think the profession should be aiming to be seen as a care profession. You can go to a GP, you can go to a doctor, you can go to a pharmacist, you can have a health professional in your organisation that looks after the care of your people. I would say we are aiming for a world, or we should be aiming for a world, where we've taken every conscious step to mitigate unnecessary harm, harm that we can help prevent.
And so I think we're really focused on the kind of the physical health, you know, the things that we can look and see. And again, when I think of, you know, my time working in construction, you know, it's the site manager focusing on the PPE and, oh, if I can see you wearing a hard hat, it's okay. But the fact that your mobile tower has been terribly erected is, you know, is not to worry about. So we focus on that. And to me, that's because of the immediate harm that comes from the safety based issues. But the health side of it, in terms of checking, like you say, checking in with people, because when we start an organization, you go through that induction process, obviously you'd expect health and safety to be a real important part, because we don't, you know, until you start on day one, we need to understand some more things about you so that, you know, we can do a risk assessment that's tailored to you specifically. And I think at times that bit gets missed. We have a risk assessment for an activity, but it's, well, hang on a minute. We've got a person here. What do we need to know about that person, and how can we support them, both from, well, okay, it might be something physical, but what about where's their actual starting point for their well-being? Now, that's a hard kind of question to ask, is, well, right, you're coming in on day one, tell me about where's your head at.
I think this is, and I've said this so many times, I think well-being is the evolution of the safety profession. We've always looked after health and safety, and for me it's always been physical and mental health and physical and mental safety. So they, for me, are all the same thing, and they equate to well-being. We're just starting to really talk about, exactly as you say, health impact, and we're starting to really address mental health impact. I think the only thing you really can do is make sure that when you are, let's just say, doing a generic risk assessment, right? You could be, for me, this is the whole thing about asking, how can this operation affect this individual? If you put yourself in the rail industry and you say you could be a station worker, there is a really remote chance that poor station worker could witness a suicide, mm-hmm. right? And I talk about that with experience, because I worked in the rail industry. My brother is a Sparky in rail, and he witnessed a suicide, bless him, and so did the booking office clerk. And in the risk assessment for that station, we exactly did as you say. We looked at the physical, the ramp, and we looked at the working at height, and we looked at all the things, the moving vehicles. But we know people commit suicide on rail. We know that that's what people do. But yet, even early days, we were failing to say, oh, how are people affected by this? And can we embed this into a risk assessment? Because this happens. So I think it's an evolution.
Hoping you know, he's okay following that incident. Mm-hmm. But how did you, you know, that sibling relationship, how did you have those conversations? Were you able to try and really understand how did that impact on him? And then, you know, presumably that's something that's not going to disappear, that stays with you for quite some time.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that I have a very similar reaction to whether you work on the station, you're related to me, or I always thought I did, or you're not related to me. I care immensely. If you've been through something, if I walk into a station, a supermarket, anywhere, and I can see somebody that's not right, mm-hmm. I can't walk past them to my meeting. I have to stop, and I have to say, you don't seem right. Are you, you know, what's going on with you? Bad day? However it is, and you start a conversation.
And that for me is one of the real important factors about health and safety professionals, is it's about having a higher level of emotional intelligence. Because I think you, I don't know, I feel like I develop a sixth sense at time where you're just looking at someone and you're like, okay, something doesn't seem right. And what I've found in times where you know, when you try and have an open door policy of come and talk to us when you've got a problem, yeah, that's great, but it still doesn't seem to generate the spark that people need. And for me, it's flipping it the other way. It's about asking questions. Are you okay? Yeah. Or how are you today? Something very small that, you know, you ask that question and then you just shut up. And if you think that they're not going to answer it, you just shut up for longer. And eventually someone then spills what's actually going on with me today.
Absolutely. I think that's one of the soft skills that we miss quite often, is that just that listening piece in that room talking about trip hazards. I had to just listen. I didn't know anything about being out in the field and tripping over stuff. When I spoke to What Three Words, I didn't know what the solution was. I had to just listen. I think you have to be highly, I think if you're going to really change culture, and that's what this is about, right?
Yeah.
You have to be so open to not knowing the answer, and also understanding that somebody else probably does, or a fraction of that answer that you can help pull together. You have to just be so open to just sit back and listen, like you say, or ask the question, how is that for you? How is that day job? How does that, you know, I often ask, what's the worst day? If someone's having a rough day, you know, and they don't want to talk about it, I'll talk around the edge and then just say, and actually just address it, just say, you don't look comfortable and I'm here, and I can write it down or not write it down, but I'm right here.
And I find, you know, that's great that you've developed those skills. I'm going to say, you know, to be comfortable and able to have that conversation. And, you know, I've discussed with people over, you know, over the last 18 months where we've had people working from home. You've got the people that, where when you see them on a day-to-day basis, you've kind of got that baseline and knowing where they are. But when you're actually not in front of them, or you're not routinely checking in with them, it's a little bit more difficult to manage that. And also it comes then down to, you know, each individual manager. You may have some managers with really good skills around, you know, around people, and they're, you know, they're prepared to check in and ask those questions. You've got some in the middle who, you know, they know it's really important, but perhaps don't know how to start those. And then you've got the people on the other side who just don't necessarily get the softer side of it, which can give you a real disparity across an organization of how people are managed. And if I think back to when I was doing my health and safety qualifications way back when, I can't really think many of those softer skills really being underpinned in what makes up a safety professional. How do we go about, you know, kind of adjusting that?
I think this is where you can see lots of different, so there's typically sort of IOSH. So way back when we were doing safety qualifications, IOSH was kind of the main thing, right?
Yeah.
But now you've got IRSM, if that's the right acronym. You've got all these other types of safety communities popping up. And I think it's sort of organically writing its own balance. And I think some of the typical traditional safety organizations are feeling the challenge to say, it's not enough just to say, you know, we can train you to a risk assessment and you can preach the law verbatim. You have to be able to care and have a conversation too. So I think it is changing things like the NCRQ.
Oh, love it. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I did diploma, closed book, back in the day when you had to drill it and recite it and stand by your bed.
And memorise, what, 60 bits of different case law?
Oh, jeez. You know?
I mean, my memory's terrible. Although every now and again, one of them just pops in there. You're like, oh, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, absolutely. And then I mentor somebody called Lee. Hey, Lee, if you're listening. And he is going through the NCRQ. It's just such a really good way of learning when you want to have a conversation about a topic rather than just drill the book. And I think qualifications like that are saying, go out and research it, go out and take this topic and what would you do? It's better.
Oh, absolutely. And funny enough, most of my team who are going through their qualifications, I don't want to make the decision for them, but I'm very much steering them towards NCRQ because it's just more practical. You know, think about the diploma that I did and a lot of the things in the test. It's like, well, I've got Google these days. That's what it's there for. I'm not expected to be able to recite all of these, but I know where to look when I need it. You're going to have a challenge. Something's going to come up and you're not going to have the answer. And even with Google, you know, if someone hasn't done it before, you know, you've got to work out how you're going to do that and how you're going to enable people to, you know, undertake an activity that may not have been done before. And, you know, it's that collaborative approach again of, well, okay, bring your safety knowledge, start thinking about hazards, but if you want to change hearts and minds on this, you need to be talking about people who, you know, who've used these bits and pieces in the past and bring that knowledge into the forefront to actually get the result that you need.
Oh, do you know what, you've just led me to such an epiphany about, we're talking about the profession, about not needing to know all the answers. And when I did NEBOSH, the feeling I got having to know this all verbatim was I needed to know the answer in the room always. Whereas NCRQ and other qualifications like that are, where can I get the answer? Who can I learn from? I think it's steering towards the next evolution of safety professional. We don't need to know all the answers. We can go and ask somebody and we can be comfortable not necessarily knowing the answer off the top of our head.
And actually, it's that point. I mean, like when I used to deliver training sessions week in, week out, you know, people would every now and again chuck a question into me whilst I was there. And I'd be like, do you know what? I really don't know.
Yeah.
You know, no one's asked it in that way before. Or, you know, I'm not a walking encyclopedia of everything to do with safety. You know, I can give you a view on it right now. But if you want something a little bit more in depth, let me take it away.
I think you were talking about mental health, and one of the things that was going through my head there about people with the softer skills to ask a question, some people that don't. I want to just say out loud here, I don't know a single person genuinely hasn't had their mental health affected by the pandemic. And so I think that's one of the, you know, we're all looking around saying, are they all right? Was it just me? Are they all right? Is that just me? Everybody had a time where they just felt like they were in prison and they couldn't get out. And I think the more we are just open with, you know, I actually had somebody come on a call with me the other day and said, how did you find the pandemic and how are you recovering from the pandemic? And I was like, oh, what a lovely question. So actually, I think I'm all right, actually. And I said, absolutely wasn't. I was like halfway through the pandemic trying to remap all the processes of Openreach mm-hmm. with Openreach and single parent and homeschooling, and I just moved away from all my family and we were alone. It was horrendous. And then she was like, oh, you were honest. Okay, yeah. Well, I found it rubbish too. And it was human.
And that's it. It's just being, again, going back to your starters, it's vulnerability. There is nothing wrong with being able to put vulnerability out there, because, you know, that conversation, you know, you think, oh, no, it's just me. But no, yeah. The common thread runs through, you know, everybody. There's a concept that I really found really helped me last year. Someone threw the term equal dignity at me, because I find that I'm very good at trying to help other people and do anything for other people. But I find at times I don't do the same for myself. And that was kind of my epiphany moment of, well, actually, no, I'm as vulnerable as anybody else can be. So if I would help somebody else, if I need help, I need to ask for it. You know, it's really important that we all do that, because, you know, at the end of the day, you know, the best leaders, the best managers who are checking in, if people are actively hiding what's going on, you know, it's, you know, change and being able to, you know, really help, really difficult. So, you know, being able for us as working in the safety industry to have that skill set and to really kind of promote that throughout our organisations.
There's an awful lot of giving yourself permission in this, I think. And I mentioned it on another podcast, and I got contacted by so many parents. I had to ask myself a question, bang in the middle of the pandemic, what I would want my guys to do in this position. And it was, Emily was bawling her eyes out on a morning. She just said, Mummy, I'm so lonely. And I'd worked, I don't know, 18-hour days. I was working my tail off, and I was on my knees. And I had this massive union call, and all these juniors wanted to haul me over the coals to say, how, you know, are you doing the best for our people? And I knew the call was important, but I knew my baby was important, but also so was I. And I thought to myself, right, what would I, if this was Hayley, my Hayley and my team, what would I want her to do? And I was like, I would want her to get on the call with her baby in her arms. Okay, cool. That's what I'm going to do. And I went on this call, and everybody looked shell-shocked. There was a child in my arms. I was rocking them. And I said, listen, I'm going to open this call by saying this. My name is Crystal Danbury, and I am your director of safety, but I'm also a mum. And this little girl right now needs her mum so much, but you also need me. And I can do both. Being a mum doesn't stop me being an incredible professional. I can do both. I am comfortable, and I'm going to proceed the meeting like this. It took everybody about 5 minutes to deal with the absolute raw vulnerability in the room.
Absolutely love it. Love it. And isn't it interesting how we've moved from just pre-pandemic, when the guy on the news has his daughter run in, and you see someone scurrying him away, and we're like, oh, that's a bit embarrassing.
Dragging them across the floor,
to now. I mean, it's so, we, you know, in some ways we've normalised that, you know, someone opening the door and interrupting or being there, because, you know, it frustrates me at times that you think, how many parents are out there, regardless of a pandemic, you know, how is it that we have not shaped work around being parents, and it's the other way around? It's that, oh my God, what, you've got to go and do the school run? twice a day. Well, that doesn't that doesn't fit with work.
Dare you?
Because we must you must be available for a 2:30 to 3:30 meeting or a 9:00 to 9:30 meeting, because it can't wait, can it?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so, how did your? I mean, I suppose if it was on a Zoom or a Teams call, you just suddenly have a lot of mouths open. Of did she really just say that?
Yep. So do you know what? 5 minutes of everyone looking at her, looking at me, looking at her, looking at me. And I rocked. She didn't say a word the whole time, right? Just rocked. Did the mum rock? You've all seen it, right? Mm-hmm. Did the mum rock? She was 4 or 5 and we did the entire meeting. Smashed the meeting out. And at the end, by the time 5 minutes in, nobody even remembered that she was sat there. And at the very end, they closed the meeting and it was a woman, the only other woman on the call. And she said, and I want to really thank you for coming on and doing all of that with that baby in your arms. And I just said, you're more than welcome. And that was the only acknowledgement after I'd done my opener and said, I'm not addressed. This is me. This is my whole self. And they closed the meeting by me just saying, thank you for being present. Thank you for being here. And, we think it's amazing.
I think we've got that challenge for our industry of helping support organisations, going forward, balance life, and work pressure. It's not difficult. We're obviously looking at, we want to use the term hybrid agile. And for me now, the employers that are really at the forefront will retain more staff. They will actually attract more talent by being flexible.
I literally wrote down as she was just before you said that the best flexible organisations will get the best talent. I totally agree. I actually had a conversation with my boss here before I came, and I said, I've got concerns about the fact that I'm a mum, and do you really understand what that means? And he put in a call just to discuss being a mum, and I did the whole thing. I did the school run, and I did, but if they isolate, are they close schools? Like, it's just me. I'm not just a parent, I'm a single parent, and that's different. And he held this call with me, and he put down the phone, and he phoned me the next day. Do you know what to say to me? I just want to tell you, I heard you, right? Everything you said, I haven't got any retort to you. I just want to say I heard you, and whatever you need to be happy and comfortable, we will do that, Crystal. We will work around it. We will make it happen. And from that moment, I was in. I was absolutely in, because the ones that can see that it's humans that build your organisations and that you can be flexible.
I mean, I genuinely remember my first job, was at 8:30 start. And if I was more than a minute late, I'd get picked up on it. But the fact that I stayed at 7-8 o'clock at times when it was needed, it was where was that? Where was the, thanks. Recognise that. But no, back to next day, you're 5 minutes late. Clearly, well-being is going to be the thing that the pandemic, if nothing else, has really heightened, and the challenge, like coming back to it, and we're not out of the woods yet, is how do we deal with what's happened, and there will be, as you said, how are people recovering from that, and how do we champion that to really nail it going forward? What will be on the well-being agenda? What do you think, in your experience, that we really need to nail?
I think the first and foremost, the thing we need to nail is communication. And that's not just communicating that we care about well-being and your well-being, but I mean a way for people to tell us that they're not okay, a way for us to identify people are not okay, somewhere for them to go if they're not okay. And we all have like EAP systems and things like that, but talk to anyone in your organisation. Do they know where it is? Do they know
or where the number
it?
Is or what it even does? No, exactly. And actually, do you know what I really like? People who've had the coloured lanyards coming back into the office. Have you seen that with the red, amber, green? And if I'm wearing red, you know what? I'm just not feeling comfortable. So I don't want to say anything about it, but I just want you to see that, give me my space. That to me was just so simple, but so effective.
Yeah, I loved it. And I think that's the whole communication can be in so many different ways. And we forget about the visual and all that sort of stuff. And, however we can make it easy for people to say I am or I'm not okay, and whether it is in a handshake or whether it's in your head, we need to, again, it would be, for me, it would be sitting in a room with all those people and just saying, how could we? I don't know the solution yet, but I know the problem is some people don't feel comfortable to say that they're not comfortable. How do we make that easy? How do we create something that's discreet and respectful.
Exactly. And I think when we, you know, when we label the term sick, we're always using sickness-based statistics. You know, for me, it's like, well, how can we have the concept of, I need a mental health day. I'm not sick, but I can tell you right now, when I woke up this morning, something's not right. And actually, I'm going to waste my energies sat in front of a screen for the next hour, 8 hours. I might just need to go out, go off, go for a walk, have some quiet time, read a book. And you know what? I'll come back tomorrow and I will feel a lot better. But unless you enable me to do that, I'm going to come in, because, you know, that could be to my detriment. I might not have, you know, I might not get paid sick. And so let's just compound the problem further.
I think the mental health day is, I think, so interesting. And I still don't know how I would deal with if one of my guys just phoned up and said, I know I've got all this really important stuff today, Crystal, but I just can't. And you're like, oh, God, because naturally the other impact is somebody else has to pick up the fire.
Yep.
So for me, it's like, how do we create space to catch you before you've fallen over?
It makes me think of, no one ever talks about, let's do a well-being audit. You know, we would talk about, you know, an audit on what's going on a safety point of view, but how do we actually check in to see where is the base level? You know, where are people at within the organization? Because we know what's happened. We know where people have been at times. We know when they were at their heightened, but, and that starts to naturally run off. But are we really aware of where people are?
You know, people roll their eyes at company surveys, and that's because we just reissue the same questions year on year and they get dry. I think if you have a really big, decent company survey with properly targeted questions about how you're feeling, your people will tell you. And it's just then about your appetite to take that and learn from it. Again, don't know that we know the problem. We don't know the solution yet, but let's try and figure out. Let's pull people in.
That, to me, is how you frame it, because you're spot on. It's like, one, you have to send out the survey really, really well thought about, but it's about how do you frame it. It's say, look, we want to be, you know, from leadership point of view, we want to be better. We don't know what that looks like, but what we do know is there's lots of you out there, and we want your knowledge and we want your ideas. We don't know how long it's going to take, but we want to do something about it. And people being, you know, being able to put the past in the past, leave it where it is. You know, we might not have got it right leading up to where we are now, but we want to do something going forward. Crystal, why would you encourage someone to work in health and safety in our industry?
Well, I genuinely think it's the best job in the world. So if I was in the pub and you said to me, why should I work in your profession? I would say to you, because I get to see every single facet of an organisation. I get to see every single role, every single risk, every single control. I get to see all the planning, all the betterment, and I get to care about every single part, equipment and person within that organisation. Most parts of an organisation have a part that they look after and care for. I get to care for the lot. And who gets that?
Oh, absolutely. And I love that word, care. You know, it's, yeah. And again, I just keep thinking back to what I said at the beginning in terms of the introduction, putting the heart back into health and safety. That is just so powerful.
That's what it is. It is a care profession, and we forgot. And I just think, I get to care for every single person. And also, I get to care about a whole team that care about them too. So it's magic. I think the profession is magic.
And, you know, I've been there in the pub, you know, people asking what you do. And, you know, you have that initial awkward moment where people are like, oh. But then you say, well, hold on a minute. When things go wrong, they want you. They really want you. It's like, well, can we not be in a place where actually things just don't go wrong because of what we do?
Absolutely. Well, do you know what I respond with? I respond with, I'm in charge of getting 200,000 people home.
Actually, that sounds like a much better job title, Crystal. Maybe we should just all change that. That should be on our LinkedIn profiles. It's that actually this is the reality of what we're responsible for. It just really, you know, really flips it in the other way. And, you know, we're focusing on people, because at the end of the day, you know, they're the lifeblood of our organization, and that's what we need to do. So that's it for today. Thank you so much, Crystal, for spending your time with us, and look forward to speaking to you again in the future.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been my absolute pleasure.
Thanks so much for listening to Risk Sleep Repeat. If you'd like to appear on the show, if there's a topic you'd like to discuss, or if you want to let us know your thoughts, please do so using the hashtag Risk Sleep Repeat, or get in touch via our website at praxis42.com.